All right. Solutions, midterm.
Not necessarily unique.
There are some problems that we're working on.
So any questions coming to that?
So spring break is next week. Halfway through the semester.
So I have almost filled one of these books, so I'm starting a new book for the second half of the course. So all those notes are online under the lecture section. As are the audios. Right. Hello. Okay, so I wanted to keep talking about galaxy formation and talk a little first about elliptical galaxies. How batteries completely die, apparently. Not even a little juice left in these. Better to be armed in front of the classroom anyway. Okay. There, an elliptical galaxy. This is perhaps a prototypical elliptical galaxy, M87 in the Virgo cluster. There is a morphology density relation, that is, earlier type galaxies tend to live in denser parts of the universe, and so seeing big ellipticals near the centers of the clusters of galaxies is pretty normal. See others around there, just the way it is. There's a lot of nomenclature, sometimes people say these days ETG for early type galaxy. And when they say that, they usually mean that in ellipticals and lenticulars as well, or S0 galaxies. Here's a decent picture of an S0 galaxy. It's really hard to tell the difference. Unless it's edge-on, so you can see the disk component. Basically, a lenticular is an elliptical with a tiny disk to go with it. And if it's not edge-on, it's hard to see the disk. So one is hard-pressed to say that is a different morphological type than that. Right, but you can just see there's some ellipticity projected on the sky, and have some combination of the intrinsic shape of the thing and projection. No reason the major axis has to be in the sky. Same thing there. And in fact, the human eye brain is pretty good at this. While it is difficult to tell those two apart, people who've trained to do the morphology can usually agree on what the difference is. Whereas it's virtually impossible to train a computer to do that. You can train a computer to recognize late types and early types. Very hard to train it to distinguish between ellipticals and lenticulars. And then you also have shell galaxies. This is an example I show you for two reasons. One, we have a special colloquium today at 3, where Catherine Johnson also giving the Frontiers talk at the Natural History Museum tonight. We'll be talking about streams and things, probably, I'm guessing, in our own Milky Way halo. But here's examples of things in another galaxy. If you look hard enough, these things are ubiquitous. But they're also at a tiny level,
the integrated light and all these shell features is a few percent of the total light. And this is a fairly extreme case where it's easy to see the shells. In most cases, it's much less than 1%. But these are the signatures of recent mergers. You drop the little dwarf galaxy into the big galaxy, it gets fretted in this characteristic way. And those shell features diffuse over time as the stars migrate away from where they started out. But right now you're just seeing where they are in phase space, and those shells are the turnaround points of mostly radial orbits, so they congregate there. And then over time it'll just diffuse away. People argue about how long those things are visible, but it's just order a giga year, maybe a few giga years, maybe less than a giga year, but certainly not forever. So I think we did it here last time before midterm. This has been known sort of forever as a generic view of the star formation history of elliptical and spiral galaxies. Spirals roughly constant, baking around, maybe a little enhanced star formation early on, but approximately constant or very slowly declining. Whereas the stars and ellipticals are mostly old. Now some young stars, but most of the mass is in old stars, and so there had to be a lot of star formation early on, and then those die off. All right, so. Darkness anymore. As well as morphologically, these things distinguish themselves in color. This is D minus R from the slow survey. So basically a really blue color against a reddish color. And that color is a function of stellar mass, so basically luminosity, but they've used some population prescription to work out the corresponding stellar mass. And then here's all the data. You can see two distinct groupings. One is the red sequence, and these are almost always early-type galaxies, ellipticals and lenticulars. And a blue sequence, these are the things that are forming stars, hence they're blue. So late-type galaxies, which we need here to be basically all the spirals and later type irregulars along in there. So that's what people mean when they say red sequence, blue sequence. And green valley is things that one imagines is transitioning between the two, because they recently stopped forming stars and are migrating from here to here in polar space or something like that. Note, however, that ellipticals are the most massive things out there, right? The things with high stellar mass are usually early type. That does not preclude them from being low stellar mass. Sloan is not a deep survey. It is a big survey, but it's not particularly deep. And so, big on the sky. So this is 10 to the 9 solar masses of stars, and it just doesn't find anything that small. That's not because they're not there, it's because it doesn't see very far out when you're talking about little bitty galaxies. So these sequences can well extend to lower mass. And sometimes this is called the so-called star-forming main sequence. So now this is the star formation rate measured by H-alpha, basically counting H-alpha photons, which is proportional to UV photons, which are produced by O and B stars, which only live a little amount of time. So you're basically counting how many OB stars you have and how long they live to work out the rate at which you're stars. So this is really uncertain because you're just sensitive to that short-lived population as a tiny fraction of the stellar mass, but it is representing all of the mass. You integrate up the IMF to represent all that mass. And so this is star formation rate against stellar mass. And notice here's 10 to the 9 here. So everything on this plot, right? This is the edge of this plot here. It's
stops there. So the previous slide is only to the right of that one. Always look at the axes in astronomical figures. So again, these are the blue sequence star-forming galaxies. And for most of them, the star formation rate is proportional to the stellar mass. Of course, the stellar mass is the integral of the star formation rate. Right? And if you make stars at a constant rate, you get a line of slope 1, which falls about there. So what that's telling you is that all of these later type galaxies are forming stars at a very nearly constant rate. Right? If it were perfectly constant, they'd just scatter around that line. The mean is a little bit below that, but it's only a little bit below that. Another term that you will come across sometimes is the birth rate. People use slightly different definitions, but the most sensible one. It's just the current star formation rate over the past average star formation rate. Really easy to define. It's just the current stellar mass divided by the age of the galaxy. It's like an average speed. Please don't measure your average speed before they give you a ticket. They measure your instantaneous speed. So you could mostly have been driving legally and still get a ticket if you happen to be a starburst at the moment. These guys are forming a lot of stars right now relative to their stellar mass. So those are called starbursts. Mostly they're not. Mostly B is around or a little less than 1 for these things. Now it is actually, if you go through the math of this, it's right, the stellar mass. Right, it doesn't even start at the time equal zero, presumably it doesn't, but some early epoch galaxy formation. Stellar mass just the interval of the past star formation rate. And so if it is exactly a constant, then you exactly have a linear relation here. It is, the slope of this is indistinguishable from unity. People argue about that in the literature, but as near as I can tell, it's because they don't go very far down mass, so they don't go very far down star formation rate. If you just look at the top of this, it's easy to fit something that's less than 1.
And that's probably true.
But all the way down, it's pretty close to 1. So that birth rate is very hard to elevate much above a few. You have to do something special to get a starburst about galaxy, like add a whole lot of mass to it, or some other extremity in the variation of star formation. So one thing that could explain the scatter as well as the slope is that you don't maintain exactly the same star formation rate all the time. It oscillates up and down, and that does a pretty good job of sort of explaining the scatter. Another common form that's assumed for the star formation rate is an exponential, e to the minus t over some time scale tau. And that's what these red lines are. Those are that star formation rate with different normalizations, right? The higher the absolute value of the star formation rate, basically whatever the proportionality constant would be here to make this into an equal sign. The higher the star formation rate, the more stars you make. And the arcs of the red line just show you what different e-folding times mean. So down at this end, it's 7 gigayears, 14, 28. 14 is about a Hubble time, right? So that really would be forming stars at a constant rate. That's another way of saying that these things are forming stars at an average, almost constant rate. If you want to fit it with this, you can do that, but you end up inferring very long e-folding time scales, i.e. it's falling off very slowly relative to a Hubble time. So same kind of thing. However, for elliptical galaxies, remember our elliptical galaxies, they're the things that live over here in this diagram.
And in fact, most of these things are upper limits. They don't have measured star formation. So they could be lower. They're masses. They have definite star masses, so they made stars in the past. And so now their birth rates are much less than one. Most of their bright future is in the past. Already done forming stars. And in fact, these lines, basically, you come across here very quickly as an evolutionary track, and you're done. It's just what an exponential looks like in this space. And so these continue down this way. You could do that down here too if you want. But to get to the where the elliptical galaxies are, you have e-folding times of just 2 or maybe 3 giga-years. So basically, these things form their stars in the first few giga-years of the universe.
And that's consistent with what we know about the overall star formation rate of the universe has clearly been declining over time. So one thing to bear in mind is that you don't know where those stars formed. They could have formed in situ in one big galaxy, but these are pretty massive galaxies, and so in the current hierarchical galaxy formation paradigm, those things should be built up out of smaller units. That's fine, so long as you make all the stars then, because the stars are old, you can't be making them during the mergers. So this is what people refer to as dry mergers. You make a lot of stars and small nuggets early on, and you merge those things together to make bigger galaxies, and the gas is already used up, so you don't get a big splash and another burst of star formation when that happens. It's the term dry merger.
So the red galaxy, elliptical galaxies generally don't show evidence of a burst of star formation? Is that?
Generally, okay. Not. The most of the star formation appears to have happened a long time ago.
Before the mergers.
And it gets very hard to distinguish a burst that is 10 giga-years old from one that's 13 giga-years old. So some of that could be going on as long as it all happens early.
Okay. So right. As long as it merges early and then that burst star formation happens early on, then that's right.
So what you can't do is have wet mergers at late times, which is a fairly natural thing to happen if you follow those merger trees. You have big things that come in, certainly after a few giga-years, right? When the universe is still only 8 giga-years old or something, you would have big things coming together still, but those are the ones that really have to be dry.
Okay.
But yeah, what happens in the first few giga-years stays in the first few giga-years. You just really can't resolve that. Gives the theorists a lot of freedom.
And remember, of course, that's the opposite of what we were saying about late-type galaxies. These things have cold, thin, rotating disks. They cannot have suffered a lot of merging for a long, long time. All right, so a bit about the... pressure support and isotropy parameter.
Now what I just mentioned, all that stuff about star formation, that's on a global scale. It's how many stars per solar mass made over the entire galaxy. Right, that's not the same. That's a galactic for extragalactic astronomers view on star formation. Not the same as watching individual stars form. Not really star formation.
Now we started talking out about disks, and we spent a lot of time talking about disks because they're relatively simple. In spite of how much time we spend on them, those are the easy things. Here we have the pressure-supported systems that are anisotropic, and so what you measure is the velocity dispersion along the line of sight.
Not the same as the circular velocity of the rotation curve, nor is it necessarily the same as the velocity dispersion of the whole system. Like if you're just sampling one line of sight, and if you have some 3D system that has some prolate structure, the velocity dispersion will be different in each concentration.
Oh, sure, go to lunch.
I know.
Have a good time.
All right.
Yes, he reminded me that we always send the grad students to lunch with the colloquium speakers, who are usually here on Wednesdays. So they just scheduled it at the same time. Remembering there was class then.
Probably better for him to talk to our esteemed speaker than listen to me.
Selecting the term in parentheses for the moment, you notice the usual thing. You've got a radius, you've got a square of a velocity. In this case, it's a radial velocity description. Okay, so how stars are moving in and out. It doesn't matter which axis at the moment. But just a measure of the radial in and out component of the velocity. So that's not the same as the line of sight. Same as the 3D version, which can be whatever. And the reason for that is anisotropy of the orbits. These terms here are just logarithmic slopes that come out of the Jeans equations. So this is a nice simplification of the Jeans equation. Write it this way. You'll start to recognize those terms. So this is this first term is the logarithmic slope of the number density of your tracers, stars, for example. Right, so this is analogous to what the problem we did for the restoring force to the disk. This would be the scale length in the vertical direction. The slope taking one over. That's what that term is. And that's measurable. Tracers, see how they vary with radius.
Enjoy your lunch.
Okay. The second term is again a logarithmic slope, how this radial velocity dispersion varies with radius. It's in principle possible to measure the projection of that quantity. And you can then assume something about how big it is projected to get the true value. But in practice, a lot of times it's hard to make that measurement. You just get a bulk measurement. It's constant.
kind of silly question, I just want to be sure. That's taking the natural log of sigma squared, not taking the natural log squared of sigma.
Yes.
Exactly. And if you go back and look at the structure of the G's relationships, you want to do that. But, and so, yeah, so these quantities. Have some distribution, right? So taking the natural log of that quantity's derivative, and this is just a constant, basically. So we are rewriting this in a way that is convenient for our tendency to write things as palindromes.
Sure.
Adequate descriptions of the case. So if I remember right, the radial number density stars in the galactic halo falls off as like R of the minus 3, something like that. So then 3, this is what that may come up in the low wind today. And then beta is the big one. So-called anisotropy parameter. It is where you hide many evil things. It is basically contains the information about the distribution of orbits of the stars in your object. So, tangential is the velocity dispersion. Tangential direction, perpendicular to the radial direction. So this is the range of things that can happen. And if your orbits are all radial, right, things are just going in and out in the center, then all the energy is in the radial velocity dispersion. This is zero, and you're something on the other hand, things have a lot of angular momentum, so they never go to the center, and they're just going around in a tangential direction. And this is the big part. And that goes to zero, and then this goes to minus infinity. Right? Does that go to zero? So some number of. That is, in fact, a case for purely circular orbits. So, if you have some idea of how the orbits are populated, then you can take, you can estimate this quantity and put it in here. That's why rotation curves are easy. You don't have these terms to worry about. Notice, if you get rid of this, you're basically back to a virial type estimator. So the virial estimators that we used all implicitly assume isotropy. That is, that your line of sight velocity dispersion is representative of a projection of the full 3D velocity dispersion. That's fair. That is, you would not get a different answer if you could look at the system from an orthogonal direction. that direction, it's just as good as that, it's just as good as that. That is the what the assumption of isotropy means, and that's easy because then this term is zero. But there are systems like elliptical galaxies that are clearly not round. So presumably they have some more pressure support in one direction than the other. So you can worry about this being on zero. Probably is. It's to be a big. This is actually the biggest uncertainty in a lot of problems, is what that anisotropy is for orbits. as you can see, you can get changes of factor of a few and then close mass pretty easily, just different assumptions about isotropy. Worse than that. No reason the beta has to be a number, like it can vary as a function of radius. Orbits might be more tangential down to the center, or radial further out, or vice versa. Yeah. So theorists have a lot of fun with this. The rolling fudge factor, or trying to force it to fit something.
But that's what we got to deal with for. Elliptical galaxies, and there are more sophisticated techniques to attempt to do that. Genes modeling, orbit family selection, you actually work out what some of the stable orbits in a given potential are, try to match that to your data.
So it's not as terrible as all that, but the bottom line is that there is a huge degeneracy mass and isotropy.
That's the limiting factor. You can measure the
projected velocity dispersion with arbitrary accuracy and still not know the isotropy in the mass you'll get. It's going to be degenerate with what you assume.
Still, we can measure things. So here is a common representation of the pressure support in ellipticals. It's just a ratio of rotation velocity to velocity dispersion.
So have some big elliptical galaxy, you take spectra, you measure velocities along the line of sight, you use that to measure, to construct a velocity dispersion at that point along the line of sight. And you can also, if the whole thing is rotating as some big blob, then the velocity will be systematically different from one side to the other. That's your maximum rotation velocity here. And so in this plot and cut off here, go down just a little more. Okay, this is the ellipticity of the galaxy. So this is the shape of the thing. So this is a round thing. This is a very squashed, pointy thing. And it only goes up to 0.7, like the Hubble's type E7. And so two dividing lines here. This is the line of a rotating oblate system. So a system that's squashed in one direction. It's got some rotational support, but also velocity dispersion with an isotropic orbital distribution. Those things would fall along this line. And if they're prolate, the same assumption, they'd be over here. And you can see there are a lot of elliptical galaxies, all these X's, that are slow rotating. They're mostly pressure supported. There's not a lot of rotation. V over sigma is small. Remember, for spirals, V over sigma is big, like almost 10 for the Milky Way. So they're way off scale here. And they're also thin, so they're off scale that way too. So they are very different systems in that regard. But there are other systems here that are sort of intermediate, and some of these are bulges of spiral galaxies. So basically the elliptical component in the center of a spiral galaxy. And they're intermediate. They're not just slow rotators. They're oblate rotators. So they're going with the disk in most cases, but as a thickened 3D thing rather than a thin 2D thing.
More recently, I forgot to
put the name. This is from Atlas 3D,
which I say because that is a useful survey if you want to know things about early time galaxies.
And so these folks used instrument a spectrograph, an imaging spectrograph, take spectra over a whole field of view called Sauron, to study a volume limited sample of early type galaxies, and a whole series of Atlas 3D papers. And this is the figure analogous to what I just showed you, but now they've put things in terms of this specific angular momentum here. So this is basically the ratio of rotation to everything. So that's limited at one, right? A pure circular orbit would be up at one, up here, and something that was exactly thin edge on would be over here, so up in that corner. So now spirals are at least on the, if not on the graph, close. Here's your oblate rotator line again, and that does demarcate some of the data. These things are the so-called fast rotators, and they're all over the place in this line because of projection effects. So for a given intrinsic shape, so this is a pretty round one if I remember, yeah, I think that's right. This dashed line is a round one going from things seen edge on to seen face on where they're rotating. And then as you get to more things that are intrinsically more squashed, and these dashed lines go down there, but there's still this variation there. So the fact that galaxies populate that whole part of the diagram is really just a combination of intrinsic ellipticity variations. Some things are naturally round, some things are naturally squashed, combined with projection effects, how that intrinsic ellipticity is projected onto the sky. It's just random. So that's where all those things are. And then there are the slow rotators, which they sort of arbitrarily define to be a specific angular momentum less than 0.1. These are the true big early type elliptical galaxies, like the classic things you think of an elliptical that's just a ball. And these are more oblate rotators, S0s, whatever you want to call them, or just ellipticals that happen to have some fraction of rotational support. Interesting to note, the size of these points corresponds to the stellar mass. And so these things are all big. So they do look like they are the pileup of many collisions. Things that rotation has kind of gotten erased in the hierarchical agglomeration process. So you just had chunks coming in from every which way. The flip side is not obvious that these things are built up hierarchically, or if they just have some angular momentum. Maybe. Okay. Now we will come back to the anisotropy again when we talk about dwarf elliptical galaxies, which are much lower mass than these things and are only known in detail in the local group. But those things are very dark matter dominated. These things are pretty much star dominated. Down where we're making these measurements, there's no clear need of dark matter. When we get down to dwarf spherules, that's not true, and then we have to worry about this quite a lot. But mostly I just wanted to say all that by way of introduction to the rest of the universe of galaxies. I haven't actually spent all that much time talking about it. And then go back to our galaxy formation session. All right, so timing of this, the dark matter halos start forming first. Initially, the universe is very homogeneous and expanding.
it takes some time for these to decouple and start to fall in, and then the stuff we can see, the baryons, fall in after. An oversimplification to just say it's all dark matter that you start dropping baryons in the well, but it's a useful way to think of the sequence of things. The baryons are very uniformly distributed in the early universe for a longer time than the dark matter. It's a more way to say it. Then it can start to bunch up after recombination. So once they start pumping up, then there are two things generically that happen after this. The first of which is called adiabatic contraction, which is a bit of a misnomer. Sometimes contraction or sometimes compression. They mean the same thing. And this is just the response of the dark matter halo to the infall of the a bunch of immigrant baryons, basically, to mess things up. Another way of, more accurate way of saying that is the gravitational potential is non-stationary. Because the baryons can dissipate, radiate energy, and it can sink down to the center. So whatever mass distribution you have established initially, be it an NFW halo or whatever other model you like, that initial condition established for the dark matter, remember the NFW form is just a analytic approximation to what numerical simulations do with dark matter only. Only dark matter in the simulations that do that. So you start out with an NFW halo, then you drop some baryons into it, and you have to find a new equilibrium. Things settle down. So the basic thing that happens as baryons sink to the middle, which they must do if you're going to form a galaxy in the middle, is that it makes the potential well a little deeper. So if that's some kind of radial illustration of the potential. And by dropping the baryons in, you end up with something that's a little deeper. It's very hard to draw that. And so you get a deepening of the well at the center. You do have to conserve energy, so that also changes the winds.
Yeah. So NFWs only form in dark matter only simulations, or have they been shown in SPHs?
NFW is what you get out of dark matter only simulations. If you run SPH, then other things happen that include this and other things, right? But the way I like to think of it is that NFW is the initial condition provided by the dark matter, which is the framework on which structure forms in this picture.
Okay.
And then you have modifications after that, of which adiabatic compression is the one thing you know has to happen at some level. Indeed, the earliest SPH simulations had something called there's a number of names for it. I think the most common, this was in the 90s, had the angular momentum catastrophe. And this is related to what Selwood's paper on Bard is talking about, because if you just drop these things into a static potential, then as I will describe, you can compute the response under the assumption that the changes are adiabatic. If you actually do an SPH simulation where everything is live, including the halo,
then the particles representing the baryons and the gas is dissipating, is free to exchange angular momentum with the dark matter. And guess which way that mostly goes? Is the baryons are sinking to the middle, they're mostly giving up angular momentum to the dark matter. The dark matter is a big sponge. It's, there's a lot more dark matter than there is baryon, right? So it can soak up quite a lot of angular momentum. And as people improved the resolution of their simulations, what they found was that they were forming disks of baryons in the center of the dark matter. But those disks kept getting smaller. Every time you improved the resolution, they got smaller. And that was because this was more or less a one-way exchange. The baryons were just giving up their angular momentums of the dark matter, and that only stopped when you hit the resolution limit of your simulation. And people fairly quickly got to the point where they were making galaxies that were much too small. Basically, all the dot. Hence the term angular momentum catastrophe. So the other thing that happens, well, many other things can happen, but there's sort of a generic term for it. And that is feedback. So this is next on the list. Unlike adiabatic compression, it is not fundamental. Adiabatic compression is just the response of the potential to the involved baryon. That has to happen. It doesn't have to happen adiabatically the way the main is given, but it has to happen. Feedback is not fundamental. It doesn't have to happen. But this is basically the any process that returns energy. Falling gas and more dark matter. Now mostly it's to the falling gas, because that's what interacts with whatever energy you produce. And that only couples to the dark matter through gravity. Gravity is a very weak coupling. But in principle it can happen. There are two basic types. One is from star formation. So you drop all these baryons down into your proto-galaxy and they start forming stars. Stars are little nuclear bombs. They're doing all sorts of things. And in fact, some of them explode as supernova. So that returns kinetic energy back into the gas that's trying to collapse down. A lot of energy in supernova, so in principle that could be a lot of energy. There are some arguments that it could even, in principle, unbind the baryonic component of the galaxy. So that's an example of feedback. It's not the only example. You can also have stellar winds. And this is where it gets really messy, because you see if you look on the microscale of individual stars, then you see all sorts of feedback effects in reality. Right? You see bipolar winds from perfect Haro stars that settle down on the main sequence. Those jets blast out into the interstellar medium and change the surrounding gas. Supernovae blow shells and work their way into chimneys that get out of the disk, all sorts of complicated things. So those are all real effects that we see going on. In the context of galaxy formation, that's not what we're talking about. Those are the microscale effects that you can see in these cases. We're back to talking about that macro scale star formation. You make so many star masses of stars per year, how much energy does that return to the ISM on some galaxy scale? So clearly it is going on, but it's a lot harder to say how much of an impact. So you make some stellar winds in your young stars. Does that in fact impact the entire galaxy? So that's and this is very hard to model. So this is an enormous amount of SPH and numerical modeling being done to try to address these problems at present. The other big type is AGM feedback. Basically, if you form a supermassive black hole at the center of the galaxy, presumably a baryon is moving out of Earth. And that black hole accretes material, then you can get a quasar or other form of nuclear activity, and again, you can create jets that create a price. And we do see examples of this where supermassive black holes are blasting these relativistic jets of particles into the surroundings. Again, there's a source of energy that feeds back into the surrounding galactic environment. It's another question as to what effect that has on the galaxy and the dark matter halo. Big beautiful examples I see of this, like the dot in a little galaxy, and then you'll see these things blasted out and sort of radio lobes out here, you know, 100 kiloparsecs from the galaxy or something like that. You don't want to be in the line of fire, but as long as you're not, like most of the galaxy, it's not obvious it does anything to you. But it does deposit energy at large radii, so that might have an effect on clusters, if this happens in a cluster of galaxies. So all these things are discussed, and they're much harder to quantify than the previous steps.
So that's why that's where a lot of that's going on. All right, so some words about adiabatic compression, the step that has to happen.
This was realized very early on by the group at Santa Cruz. So already in the mid-80s, people had sort of decided it was probably gold dark matter, something non-baryonic. But if you wanted to relate that to observations, then you need to account for this adiabatic compression. And so they cooked up a scheme that goes like this. And basically, this is often called to us the Blumenthal prescription. Blumenthal came up with it. And it was, you know, the first one to do it, so that was a nice contribution. But basically, if you consider masses and shells, so there's some mass and shell of the initial radii, Ri, so that's the radius of the mass. Then you let this compression go forward, then you end up shrinking things to some final radius, and you have some that's in the disk, and some final radius, right? So you're putting some things into you're settling some of the mass into a disk. And so initially the assumption was that the baryons were evenly mixed with the dark matter halo, and you're just forming the is a decent assumption to start with, and you're just forming the disk by letting them settle out of that initial distribution. So you're making a disk, you have to conserve mass, right? So some fraction of the mass goes into the disk, the rest is still there in dark matter or mixed in with dark matter. Note that you don't actually have to have 100% of the baryons go into the galaxy. And if they don't, that's just mass is still out there mixed up together. You don't really care if it's dark or baryonic. But the mass ratio says most of it is dark. And so that'll have its own shell at some final radius. And this is essentially assuming that we haven't assumed anything so far. We can make an assumption that the shells don't cross, so that basically you start out like that and you end up like that, and that's true at every radius. Right? You just kind of have an adiabatic compression that settles down. And that assumption that you conserve mass in shells is equivalent to, that's the way they put it, it's equivalent to assuming that the dark matter particles are on a perfectly circular orbit. That is not a good assumption. So it turns out that how sensitive the compression of the dark matter halo is more susceptible to being compressed, the more
circular the orbits of the dark matter particles are. You have to conserve angular momentum in any case, so if they're all on perfectly circular orbits and change the potential, then they contract a lot. If they are more pressure supported with a lot of radial orbits in and out, then that's relatively less sensitive to getting rearranged. So that's the difference between the Blumenthal algorithm and other algorithms that are out there. They make different assumptions. You can compute this rigorously. Jerry Selwood showed this and wrote the code to do it, but you actually have to keep track of everything, so it's a much harder thing to do computationally. So it hasn't been widely used. Been used some, including by myself, so here are some examples. The algorithm that Jerry implemented was actually suggested by this chap named Young way back in like 1980, 1979, considering the formation of globular clusters. But it's the same, you know, spherical collapse process. So these are the same thing, but basically it shows you the Blumenthal algorithm overcompresses. You've aimed to get the same final rotation curve, but the difference between the halos is different. It's a little subtle. Let me give you some more examples. You start with this as the initial halo, so this is what I mean by NFW being the initial condition. Right? That is just what dark matter does all by itself. And then you add the baryons in, and the halo gets compressed by this process. Now, if you go out, remember, in the Young case, we're rigorously conserving the adiabatic invariance of the halo. So if you put more mass in here, you've taken it from somewhere. And so if you go way, way out to the virial radius, then this thing has shrunk something. But here, it mostly looks like a compression. So the velocities that you attribute to dark matter go up because of the formation of this disk. Now you can see by comparison there is some difference there, and the Blumenthal method is more sensitive. It gives you more compression. And that leads to a lot of problems, actually, because it's very hard to fit the inner parts of disks without overdoing it with that method. You can get a better result if you do it right. So here's some example data. GC 2903, the real galaxy, so that's the actual observed data. This is the disk. This is just like the example I gave you on the homework. Right? Subtract that disk off, and then you want to fit what's left over. So that's what's been done. Right? This is the dark matter halo that you need to add this and that to get the total. And that thing isn't really NFW anymore. It's a compressed version of NFW. So this is the initial halo, primordial halo. So you can see how much compression there is, and it's quite noticeable for a high-density disk. The velocities have gone up tens of kilometers of seconds per second there. And the shape of that thing, if you just fit an NFW halo to it, as you did in homework, as everybody in the literature does, pretty much, without considering this effect, and the parameters you get, even if you can do it perfectly, don't really represent what you'd like it to, which is the initial condition that's actually predicted by simulations. Now, if you go to less massive disks, then the compression is less, so this is a low-mass galaxy, which has a lousy NFW fit, or even with the compressed halo, it's lousy, right? It over-predicts the velocities here. It doesn't fit this feature at all, even though it's present in the baryonic contribution. But the point here is just that the difference between the primordial and final halo is much smaller, right? It's a lower density disk, and so there is less compression along the way. But there's always compression down here. You don't observe the parts out there. It goes fairly around.
this effect only acts to boost the velocities at the small radius. Are we happy with that? This is the one effect that I would insist has to happen, and it makes the problem that we have worse, right? The long-standing problem we have with this NFW halo and the structure formation paradigm it comes from is that it has this so-called cusp core problem. It's over-predicting the velocities at small radii. This makes it worse. Right. So that's a problem. And so there are many reasons to invoke that there are these other things going on, i.e. feedback. So this is a cartoon by Joe Silk to illustrate what's going on. And so here is the disk of some star-forming galaxy. Green is the cold gas. The red is where supernova have gone off and blown bubbles, and in some cases blow out, make chimneys. See all this going on. Make chimneys in the disk. Once you make a chimney, which is basically a column of low-density hot gas, through the cold gas around it, then basically all the energy flows up through. And so that's sort of what this is showing. Material goes up, some of it may fall back down, but mostly you're getting energy channeled out down on the scale of the star-forming disk. And then you can zoom out. So here's now the whole star-forming disk. It's feeding energy back out into the surroundings. Whatever gas is still lurking in the halo. Come back down. And in addition to this star formation feedback, you can also have a big black hole that's doing the same kind of job on those scales. So that is the picture, and if it looks kind of cartoony, it is. Right? People have now made very sophisticated simulations in order to show what's going on, or try to simulate what's going on. But it's very hard because this stuff is happening at subparsec scales, right? When a star explodes, you're talking about something that's smaller than an AU. And so to do this calculation right, you need a simulation that resolves that. And you'd like to do that in a cosmological context. Right, so you'd like to simulate the entire universe and see individual stars blowing up. Okay. The dynamic range requirements are rather severe. The only computer big enough to do this right is the universe itself. So what we inevitably end up doing is assuming what is called subgrid physics. And so we will look at something about star formation locally and try to parameterize that. Say, okay, on a grid it's only 10 parsecs across, we see this much gas flowing out from this star forming region. So we'll just build that as an equation into our bigger simulation, and when the simulation gets down to its resolution element, it'll go and look at this analytic restriction to figure out what it should be. Anybody see any dangers? It requires a minimum of 3 parameters to parameterize star formation feedback, not the AGN, just the star formation. And this is really a very simplistic form. Most people do more complicated things. Remember, we already needed 3 parameters to describe the galaxy disk plus 2 to describe the dark matter halo. So now we're adding 3 more. Data that really only require 1 parameter to describe. So it's a mess. You can give any answer you want out of here, and since you are parameterizing the so-called subgrid physics with these prescriptions, if you run a simulation and you don't like the results, you go in and turn the knobs on your prescription. And you keep doing that until it looks right for whatever prescription or for whatever observation you're trying to match. So this is where
you should be very wary of theorists claiming to explain everything, because there's a lot going on under the hood that is often not,
often left unsaid. For example, one problem where this is important is the so-called missing satellite problem. The luminosity function of galaxies looks something like that blue line. The mass function of halos looks something like this red line. In fact, it is. I'm not sure why the cartoon makes it curved. It is very straight as a powerball in this diagram. And the normalizations don't match either. So somehow you have to map from this theoretical prediction to this observation, and that is one context in which feedback is invoked. And it is generally thought that supernovae are doing most of the work at the low mass end, and that AGN, massive black holes, are doing most of the work at the high mass end. And basically, that's to prevent a cluster from galaxies from forming into one really giant galaxy. Like, the luminosity function cuts off at L star, but you have halos up here, so why is a halo that's 10 to the 15 solar masses different from a halo that's 10 to the 12 solar masses? It's nothing to do with the dark matter, they're all self-similar, so it's got to be something that the baryons are doing, and that's the bogeyman. If I were to give you an assignment to explain the luminosity function of galaxies, it looks like that, and you came back with an answer that said this, what grade do you think you would give? It's not a satisfactory explanation. This may very well be going on. A lot of people in our field believe that is what is going on, but it wasn't predicted. What is predicted is that mass function of halos. What is observed does not map gracefully from that. Okay? And so a lot of what goes on in the field is trying to figure out how you can map from one to the other. All right. It's spring break, so I think that's a good place to stop. We'll see you a couple weeks hence.